Hello and welcome to the Vet Blast podcast. I am your host, Dr. Adam Christman, Chief Veterinary Officer here at Fetch DVM 360.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Vet Blast podcast. What are the top five behaviors every clinician should recognize? I'm sure there's a boatload. I know there's a boatload, but for the interest of this podcast, we're going to really dive deep onto those five, plus some other questions that we have. And joining us is our wonderful colleague, board certified veterinary behaviorist, Dr. Ori Stoller in the house. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. Yes. Thanks for joining us on the show. And a little information about our wonderful colleague. Dr. Stoller completed his DVM degree at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem in 2012, and he moved to the state of Indiana in 2018, where he completed his residency in veterinary behavior, the veterinary equivalent of psychiatry, which is so true, at Purdue University's College of Vet Med, and graduated in 2021. My goodness. What made you, by the way, become interested in veterinary behavior?
So my two things. One, my wife, that at the time was a dog trainer, or on the way to becoming a dog trainer. And two, my dog, which was crazy in a way. I had to learn how to deal with it. And, you know.
Wow, that's fantastic. It's not an easy one. And so he's now your practicing general practitioner and veterinary behavior specialist, and his goal is to create the best experience for both pets and their caretakers by implementing stress reduction methods during and when needed before the visit. He also enjoys performing soft tissue surgical procedures. And Ori moved to Massachusetts in 2024 with his wife and kids after working 3 years in Queens, New York, because his wife is now a veterinary medicine student.
Yes.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. We're going to have two in the family.
Yeah. Congratulations. Also, he enjoys making YouTube videos where you can catch him on Dr. Orion, the veterinarian, playing frisbee with his kids as well, and the guitar, and recently adopted an adorable kitten named Breadstick that might make a cameo appearance.
Probably.
Yeah, I love it. Okay, so let's go into the top five. So what are the top five behaviors every clinician or technician should be able to recognize?
Yeah, and I think that actually is relevant not for just professionals, but for every person that has, I would say mostly dogs, but some of the behaviors are also relevant for cats as well. Because we want to be able to know when they're actually, in a way, signaling that they're in stress. And the problem is that a lot of times we might ignore these five behaviors and think, or we might see them and think that they're actually something else. So one thing I would combine two together would be lip licking and yawning. So these are two behaviors that we call displacement behaviors. So they're normal behaviors, right? But if all of a sudden the cat or the dog is doing these behaviors during the physical exam or during an interaction that might be stressful for them, then that's a sign for us to know that they're actually anxious. And there are a lot of behavioral studies, and the only stress signs that was significant between the stressed animals and the calm animals was something like lip licking. So lip licking is a big one. It looks like very small. They would do it for like a second and go on. But if you see that they start doing it over and over and over again, something is going on. So I would put these two under one. The next one, that one I would say is more an obvious one, but sadly some people will still ignore it. And that would be the pile erection or the heckles up. So, you know, we know it might not indicate exactly the same thing in dogs and cats, but in both of these situations, it does indicate that the pet is in stress and a very high level of stress. And that means we need to do something about it, like either stay away if possible, or, you know, maybe schedule the appointment for a different time and think of doing something to calm the pet down before the next time we see them. Next one I would say would be whale eyes. It's kind of like showing I would say it's probably more relevant in dogs, but when they kind of like look at you, but they look at you from the side, so you can actually see the white of the eye, Now, in people, it's very important. This is how we know that someone is looking at us because we can see where the pupil is, kind of like compared to the white of the eyes. Like if I'm going to be looking to the side, you're going to see much more of the white. You know that I'm not looking at you. In animals, it's just the opposite. We usually don't see the white of their eyes. In some breeds, we do, but I'm talking about kind of like the average animal. So if all of a sudden we see that they're kind of like looking from the side, giving us this stare, and we see a lot of the white of their eye, meaning that they're doing the whale eyes. Again, it might indicate stress or even like one step before even biting us or attacking us. The fourth one would be freezing. So a lot of time we talk about the fight or flight, but nowadays we would say fight, flight, or freeze, and some would say even fidget. Freezing is a big one because a lot of us, including me, by the way, I'm not perfect. Don't tell my wife, but I'm not perfect. I see a lot of veterinarians and a lot of techs that would think that if the pet is actually not moving, it means that they're calm. But it's probably just the opposite. I mean, we see how like a puppy that still doesn't have any fear or any anxiety comes to the clinic and he's exploring. Oh, same for kittens. They're exploring. They let us touch them. They sniff us. Very different from when they come and they're kind of like just standing there, or even during the physical exam, they're just like very stiff in a way and freezing. Very big sign of stress. And the last one would be in cats would be kind of like that tail twitching, which a lot of people might sometimes think is a cat wagging its tail, or the equivalence of a cat wagging its tail, which is not, because cats don't really wag their tails. And if I'm talking about dogs wagging their tails, there's also different types of tail wags. So, for example, there's the happy, all the butt is moving and the tail is going kind of like in sort of like an eight figure, which is usually a very happy wag tail, and that's the one we want to see. But if it's like a low, fast wag tail, then it is an indication of stress. So not every time you see a dog that's wagging its tail, and definitely a cat that's kind of like flicking or twitching the tail, these are actually signs of stress. And I think these are the five.
Those are fantastic. And I've always been said or been taught like to trust the wiggle, not the wag kind of a thing with dogs. Because to your point, we were talking about hackles. There are so many times where I would see dogs that would have their hackles up and the tails going at the same time. And maybe to a layperson, they may be like, oh, they look happy. But no, they're really saying, hey, I don't feel safe. I don't feel, content right now. So those are great signs.
And a lot of times, you might actually see a few of these things going on at the same time, which makes it easier for us. But sometimes we're just going to see the one thing.
I'm laughing too because you're talking about whale eyes. Like I have dachshunds, and when you own a dachshund, they're always judging you. And so there's a difference. Just something funny is because when they look at you, they're looking up at you like, "What are you doing now?" Like, are you kidding me? But I know what you mean with the whale eyes in the exam room. Of course, they can give you like the side eye, like, "Oh, I don't feel safe or whatever. What are you doing?" But it's just funny because like you see a lot of the whale eyes at home when they're trying to do something or they're up to something trouble. They know they got caught.
So a lot of these behaviors, by the way, and it's also important to say, the context means a lot, right? I mean, the same behavior at the vet clinic might mean something completely different than when they're home. Because, sometimes lip licking can be because they're hungry, or yawning might be because they're tired, right? But if we see that it's happening a lot, and kind of like this, the whale eye, like the stare that doesn't go away at the clinic, it probably means something else.
Yes, absolutely. And this also boils down to the history taking and, physical exam and asking questions. So tell us a little bit more. How should veterinarians and technicians collect behavior information, such as when we talk about physical exam and history taking?
So I would say that there are like two different levels. There's the level of, let's say, someone that comes to you for an actual consultation. And I'm not talking to a veterinary behavior specialist. I mean, any of us can collect behavioral information. So if they are coming for something like that, there are some questionnaires that the owners can fill up and send or share to with the veterinarian ahead of time. For example, on Dr. Gary Landsberg's book, Behavior Problems of the Dog and Cat. And I'm not getting any kickback for mentioning this book. I just like it. But he has questionnaires there that, of course, people can or veterinarians can pick and choose which questions they think are more important or less important, and kind of like build their own questionnaire. I would probably recommend using that as a base and creating something that might be a little bit shorter, because usually our questionnaires, like the behaviorist questionnaires, are pretty long. They can be like 20, 30 pages long. And you know, a veterinarian is not going to have the time for each appointment to start reading something that long. So creating that behavior questionnaire, something that you can kind of like read ahead of time, 5 to 10 minutes, that would make things great. The second thing I usually recommend doing is asking the owners for video recordings. So if we know again that they're coming in for something specific, some weird behavior, might not necessarily be behavior due to behavior problems, might be because of medical thing. We want to know what's going on. You know how it is when people describe the dog suddenly collapsed. Is it a syncope? Is it a seizure? Is it pain? The video can help us a lot. Instead, or you know, they're coughing, retching, and they start explaining, and you're trying to do the kennel cough imitation to say, does it sound like that? And you know, so having them actually show you a video is great. And a lot of times, by the way, you just need to ask them when they're at the visit, because a lot of owners nowadays will do it automatically, but they don't remember that they took it unless you actually ask them. So that's a big one. Then when they're at the clinic, you want to do the observation. You know, before you're actually touching them, you want to let them roam around the room if it's safe. And while you're talking to the owners and asking questions and all of that, it also helps the dog or the cat hopefully calm down a little bit before you just jump and start touching. And then the last thing would be the physical exam. And when we do the physical exam, we do try to kind of like find what the pet's limits are and try to start with the things that, of course, depending on the species and the specific pet, which is also always good to log in the record to say, okay, this dog is a head shy. So we know that that's going to be the last thing we're going to examine. But basically trying to do what's nowadays is called a fear-free exam, and try to get as much physical information as we can without stressing the pet even more.
Excellent. Love this. Great information. And, sometimes we'll see them come to us for true behavioral problems, or the medical disease is masking or showing signs of behavior. And what diagnostics are necessary when trying to determine if a behavior change is secondary to medical conditions, or if it's pure behavior like inappropriate elimination, for instance?
And this is actually a big one, because again, a lot of times we might look at something, and you brought up the inappropriate urination or defecation. I would say specifically defecation, almost always, like I would say that in my experience, 95% of the time when I'm seeing someone for defecating outside of the litter box, for example, for a cat, it's medical and not behavioral. And you know, sometimes it might be tricky to figure out what's going on. And that's why other than doing the history and doing the physical exam, we do need to do the more, kind of like I say, basic diagnostics and the more advanced diagnostics. So as far as the basic ones, the minimal database. So we want to do a CBC. We want to make sure there's no like anemia. There's no indication of inflammation. Sometimes, we can see according to the WBC profile, we can actually see what white blood cells are elevated and say, oh, the eosinophils are really high, then maybe something parasitic or allergic or something like that. A chemistry panel also gives us so much information as far as, liver, kidneys, thyroid levels. I also recommended to kind of like including it as well. Some of it I would say is in a way anecdotal, but if you'll ask most of the behavior specialists, they will say that it does seem like even things like hypothyroidism, because everyone knows like hyperthyroidism can change the cat's behavior, no doubt about it. But even hypothyroidism in dogs, that the few studies that were done didn't find a good association between the two things, it does seem like it has an effect. Because everything that makes the pet feel uncomfortable can lead to like a behavioral change. So, we want to do the thyroid, we want to do a urinalysis. The number of times that I find a urinary tract infection in older pets, even though they're not peeing all over the house, but it does cause pain, I can't even count anymore. And even a basic fecal test or one of those GI PCR panels for fecal, also try and figure out if there are any like parasites that are causing it. If we are dealing with something like gastrointestinal behaviors and stuff like that, then a lot of times it's also worth doing B12 and folate levels. And these are kind of like I would say the really, really, really basic things. Now, depending on what we think is going on, we might want to do the more advanced things like an MRI, X-rays, and stuff like that. I can give an example of something that just happened with one of my patients that all of a sudden start behaving differently and was like really lethargic and not interested in doing anything. And I collect the information, and they actually work with a lot of good dermatologists and internal medicine specialists as well. And they kind of like wanted to see what I think about the case. And because of the things that they described, especially the lethargy, and we didn't change anything with the behavioral medications that might cause sometimes lethargy. We didn't change anything, but this lethargy was a new thing. They went to their primary read, did blood work, everything was fine. I said, I still think you should go to maybe even like a neurologist or a surgeon and do an exam to see if there's like any neurological deficits or signs of pain. And surprise, surprise, the dog has a new slip disc, IVDD, which was causing the pain. And well, the dog wasn't lethargic, it was in pain.
Yeah, I know that all too well with my guys, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, well, you have a
Yeah.
breed that's known for it.
Yes, absolutely. I had a Labrador Retriever as a patient of mine that I saw, and I remember the owner was noticing that he was getting increasingly aggressive over time. And we were like going through history taking, and this is a great case of like just doing the minimum database. And so history, nothing really out of the ordinary that made it realize, oh, that's just some blood work done. Well, he came up strong positive for Lyme disease. And as soon as we got it, I'm telling you, it was crazy. It's like she said within 24 hours of like getting him on doxycycline and pain meds, she like went back to normal because that's how irritated and irritable he was. So it really just, again, like it always is a good reminder, do the minimum database because you just don't know what you're going to find. And then, investigate a little further.
And I will say that I kind of like usually put it under the diagnostics,
Yeah.
but a type of if I still don't believe, like let's say we did everything, we couldn't find anything, and I still believe it's not a behavioral issue. In most cases, I would think it has something to do with pain. I will do a trial with the nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories or whatever pain medication that's safest for the pet. Keep them on it for at least several weeks, because sometimes just a week is not enough. Sometimes you actually need to have them on the NSAID for like 3, 4 weeks before you see improvement. And if you do, and everything kind of goes away, then in a way, it's not a full diagnosis, but in a way, you have a diagnosis by treating.
Yeah, absolutely. And at what point would it would be time for me, the primary care, to refer to you, the behaviorist? At what point, when I'm thinking something like maybe it's like caprophagy or, severe separation anxiety, noise aversions, and I just can't get things under control, what does that look like?
Yeah, so basically, whenever anyone feels that it's too much for them to treat, let's say you already gave it a shot, you tried one, two, even several medications like psychopharmacology, didn't really do too much, but you really believe that there's still something to be done, then yes, definitely refer those cases. So anything that might not even be a complicated case. I do have people, other veterinarians refer cases to me that are not really difficult. They just prefer the specialist to do it, and it's okay. We're being paid to do it, so we don't care. I mean, whatever you send our way, we're gonna take it. That's one thing. Another thing would be situations where you have a concern about safety and even liability. So maybe not your own liability, but you say, okay, it's a family that has babies or has really kids, young kids in the house, and they have a dog that already beat people or has a very high, I don't know, hunting drive or something like that. And you don't really know how to address it in a safe way, or you don't want to say something that you think might end up with the dog, biting someone, and then they're going to blame you for it. And technically, in a way, you'll be liable for it. We might not be able to do more than you, but because it's kind of like our bread and butter in a way, we deal with it a lot. So we know how to say those things to the clients and even sometimes tell them, look, this dog, we might be able to help you a little bit, but he is aggressive. There's always the chance that he's going to bite someone. These are the safety measures that you need to take. And then, we send the client the visit summary, we send the veterinarian the visit summary, and then, everything is logged. So for safety reasons and for liability. And then it kind of like, I think everyone feels much more comfortable. As far as the process itself, it's actually pretty easy. I mean, I guess it's different for different veterinarians, but or different behaviorists. But in most cases, I know that it would usually be just, sending the patient or the client our way. We'll tell them the cost, we'll tell them how to fill up the questionnaire, and we'll set up the meeting and all of that. And we'll want the referring veterinarian to send us the medical records, like any blood work, any history that might or might not be relevant. Because as I mentioned, sometimes we might find something in the medical record that might indicate that the patient is experiencing pain and it was overlooked. So it's good for us to have kind of like the full picture.
And you know what, too? It's just we don't have the time. Especially to dedicate and behavior. Just exactly to your point, you're doing a big medical history, you're spending a lot of time with the owner, giving them great, recommendations. And when they're seeing, the GP, where it's like 20 to 30 minutes, and it's usually you're trying to rule out the primary reasons, and then there's a recheck probably in another one. And that's what I love working with you. And I love working collaboratively like that because it is a teamwork-based approach, just exactly what you said. And it's just trying to get sometimes it can be challenging to get the pet owner on board with the why behind the referral. But yeah, it's so much information that we get from the behaviorists. So good. Excellent. Well, this is fantastic, my friend. So tell me about your YouTube video channel.
Yeah, so I mean, It's been going on for a few years now. I'm mainly trying to get people to understand that not everything you see online on social media, like TikTok, and sadly even television, right? Because I think a lot of dog trainers started by watching videos of Cesar Millan. But if you ask most, if not all, of the veterinary behaviorists, we don't agree with a lot of his methods because he, for example, uses a lot of flooding or a lot of alpha theory and dominance theory and all of those things that if you go and look at the actual studies, you see that it's, let me say it nicely, it's not very accurate. And the problem is that those that suffer in the end are the dogs, are the pets, and of course it can actually create more problems to the dog owners and then kind of like shut down the dog from showing us those warning signs and end up with the dog actually becoming a ticking time bomb, not showing signs of anxiety or fear and biting all of the sudden because of using very aversive kind of training. So in my channel, I try to explain it and kind of give alternatives and talk about many different types of behavior problems and kind of like what you can do about it in general.
It's so helpful that you do those. So thank you for putting those out there. And it's just one of those great things because now more so than ever, I'm seeing a lot of AI generated veterinarians that just don't exist. So you and I need to do our job to go out there, and those of you tuning in, to really be the subject matter expert, to your point, in the social media website space, to kind of help these pet owners, empower them with the knowledge and tools that they need, so they can see their veterinarian and say, "Hey, I saw this video on Dr. Orion's. It sounds similar. What are your thoughts?" So, thank you for all the great work that you do with that.
As long as nobody thinks that I'm AI,
But
then
no,
we're
you're not.
good.
You're the real deal.
I mean, who's gonna fake this accent?
No, you sound great, my friend. Really, thank you for all the great work that you do. Really, it was so great having you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Thank you for tuning in. Don't forget to rate this fantastic podcast as we continue to grow and have other great guests. If you're interested in becoming a guest here on the Vet Blast podcast, send us a DM. We'd love to hear from you. And until with that, we'll see you next time right here on the Vet Blast podcast. Take care, everyone.
Thank you for listening to the Vet Blast podcast with me, Dr. Adam Christman. Tune in next time. Remember, take care of your animals and always stay pawsome.